T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi, and thanks for joining us today. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about in this week's show, including a possible new breast cancer vaccine and who might benefit from this, plus a closer look at 2 new heart-related studies and an update on that polio-like illness that's hitting children hard across the country. Let's get started by talking with our co-host, SLU Care's Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital, and he's an infectious diseases specialist. Dr. Patel, thanks for being here again.
As always, great to be here.
A multi-state salmonella outbreak is spreading across the country. It's putting the poultry industry under the microscope. Let's hear about that from Sabrina Cupid.
29 states are reporting cases. 21 people have ended up in the hospital after eating contaminated chicken products. And the CDC's Colin Basler says it's not just one supplier.
58 different facilities. So this seems to be a wider problem in the industry.
He says they have notified the poultry industry of their investigation. They are not telling consumers to stop eating chicken, but instead to make sure that it is cooked thoroughly. To make matters worse, the strain of salmonella in this outbreak appears to be antibiotic resistant. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
3 cases so far in Missouri, 5 in Illinois. Dr. Patel, what do we need to know?
Well, as always, these food-related outbreaks are always concerning, and they still haven't identified a source, and it is widespread, so that's concerning as well. There's always been concerns amongst the medical community related to the overuse of antibiotics, especially in animal feed, and the fact that this outbreak is a drug-resistant outbreak suggests that it might be associated with prior antibiotic exposure, either in the animal husbandry arena or in some other exposure-related incident. And so, to me, the concern is that we need to make sure that we are containing the outbreak, identifying where the outbreak's coming from, and then also trying to reduce the use of antibiotics in the food industry. I think that that's a high risk for us as a society, because we only have a certain limited number of antibiotics, and these bacteria keep mutating at such a fast rate that it's really hard to keep ahead of that. And if we run out of all the antibiotic choices we have, we're going to be in problems when patients are coming in with needing treatment for diseases and we don't have any antibiotics to help them with.
So this outbreak should serve as a reminder to us to follow some food safety guidelines?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, a good preparation of food, making sure it's cooked thoroughly, as mentioned in the news report, that you are not you're avoiding cross-contamination of raw meats with foods that are eaten raw, things like vegetables or salads, and keeping the cooking area, food preparation areas segregated so you're not cross-contaminating foods. I think that's very important. And of course, hand hygiene is important as you're preparing food, going from raw to raw meats and things like that to vegetables, for example. You want to make sure you're washing your hands thoroughly between that.
Legionnaire's disease is back in the news. We heard this past week about 6 Champaign-Urbana residents being diagnosed with Legionnaire's disease. Remind us, what is Legionnaire's disease?
Legionella is a bacteria that typically is associated with cooling towers, air conditioning units, stagnating water. And essentially, once the bacteria gets aerosolized, it can cause infection in people. Frequently, it can cause a series of fevers. The prototypic syndrome is called Pontiac fever after Pontiac, Michigan, where it was first identified. And then it can cause a severe pneumonia syndrome called Legionnaire's disease after the American Legion Hall, where the outbreak was first identified in Philadelphia. And so it's an important disease because there's a lot of folks that are susceptible to it. It's slightly more unusual towards the end of the summer season, but in my mind, again, it could happen at any point. When you're sort of stirring up and aerosolizing water that's been stagnating, that's when you can get these outbreaks.
Is there anything we can do to prevent it?
Well, there's two components. I think that maintaining your own HVAC system is important. And then from a public policy perspective, hospitals, commercial buildings, public spaces, they need to be held to high water testing standards to make sure that they're not having Legionella in, for example, in their cooling towers or in their potable water systems. And so both things are important. Also, chlorination of water helps control Legionella, and so that's another important mechanism to contain outbreaks such as this.
Last week, we talked about an outbreak of acute flaccid myelitis across the United States. This week, the CDC is out with an update.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is reporting 127 patients are under investigation for acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM. 62 cases of the rare but serious condition have now been confirmed in 22 states.
This is truly a mystery disease. We actually don't know what's causing this increase in cases. For some of the previous cases, we've identified one pathogen or another, but we have no unifying diagnosis.
Tom Hansen, CBS News, New York.
Still a mystery?
Yeah, still a mystery. Unfortunately, this is a challenge and is not that surprising with this sort of disease, but is still frustrating nonetheless. They're not able to get to a single common virus that's causing the symptoms, that's causing the disease. And then again, we're still not sure. We first have to identify what the virus is, right? But then we have to identify the why. So is it the virus that's causing infection directly and causing injury or damage to nerve cells that causes the paralysis? Or is it some interaction with your body that leads to this this problem? So still a lot of unanswered questions and worrisome nonetheless.
What are the symptoms we should be looking out for?
Unfortunately, the symptoms are very nonspecific. Fevers, chills, malaise. It's been happening more in kids. And so with kids, irritability, poor feeding, a weight loss, which is unusual. And most of those symptoms are the same that you would expect with any respiratory virus disease. And so in this case, I think that the concern is that it can progress to the paralysis portion. And that's not atypical. That's not unusual. It would very similar to how polio presented, some vague viral symptoms and then the paralysis.
So when should you decide whether you need to seek immediate medical care?
Well, I think that if the symptoms progress, right, if you are having trouble breathing or if child is having trouble breathing, if you notice that your child just doesn't look right and it's that mother's instinct or that gut feeling that you're getting that things aren't going well, I think that's when you need to get checked in.
I don't know if you saw the reboot of the reboot of the Roseanne show, The Conners, this past week. They dealt with the death of the TV character Roseanne. And here's how they portrayed Roseanne's death.
Dan, can I talk to you for a minute?
I just got a call from a friend in the coroner's office. The autopsy found that it wasn't a heart attack. Roseanne OD'd on opioids.
Not possible. We knew she had a problem. She was only on pain pills for 2 days after surgery. Then it was just ibuprofen. It's got to be wrong.
Well, I wish it was, but they think that she must have taken the pills right before bed. And with her health issues, it was enough to stop her breathing.
Wait, what? Mom overdosed?
It doesn't make any sense. I got her knees fixed. I flushed all her pills.
Oh, my God. I found these pills in Mom's closet.
How common is a story like this?
Unfortunately, the story is very common. And I'm glad that they were able to highlight a human element to the opioid epidemic and bring it up as a real issue. For a lot of patients, this is exactly how this begins. Most patients have a acute pain need, a surgical intervention that was that needed appropriate pain control. And then, unfortunately, it can progress. And in that situation, the technique that was highlighted, you know, removing the opiates from the environment, they can still be insufficient. Folks, if they get addicted, they can go and find other sources of pain medications to feed into the addiction.
So in a lot of these cases, an addict doesn't start out seeking drugs. It just is a result of the treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the key elements here is that it's not like people are trying to get addicted. It's addiction is a disease that requires appropriate medical therapy. And so it is unmasked, if you want to say, by the exposure to the opiate pain medications, which, again, are appropriately used for severe pain associated with surgery or with, again, certain particular conditions. And then, a new disease, addiction in this case, is unmasked by that initial exposure.
Talking about another story now, a recent study just found that weight loss surgery may be even more beneficial than doctors first realized.
A new study shows that obesity surgery could reduce the danger of heart attacks and strokes for those with diabetes. Researchers followed around 20,000 patients with type 2 diabetes who were also severely obese. Those who had the surgery had a 40% lower chance of having a heart attack or stroke during the next 5 years. The results reinforce the importance of weight loss in those with diabetes. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
So weight loss and diabetes, something you want to talk about?
Absolutely. I think that there's somewhat an outmoded term, but it may be more applicable in this situation, and that's a syndrome called metabolic syndrome. It's associated with centripetal obesity, meaning fat and weight that you're carrying along your waistline, associated with blood sugars that are borderline that can progress to diabetes, associated with cholesterol that's borderline that can progress to high cholesterol, associated with blood pressure that's borderline that can progress to high blood pressure. And so you can imagine that all of these things are kind of tied together. Reducing weight can help then prevent you from getting diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol, all of which then predispose you to having cardiovascular disease, heart disease. And so it's really that weight that kind of keeps that all tied together. And if you can eliminate the source of that problem, the weight, then you can reduce the risk of any one of these other chronic diseases.
Dr. Patel, I wanted to ask you about all those medical commercials we see on TV these days, advertising medical products, prescription products that you could get if you ask your doctor. The government now is proposing drug makers reveal in those ads the list price, too. Here's what CBS's Vicky Barker reported.
If your racing thoughts keep you awake.
If the Trump administration has its way, this ad for Lunesta sleeping pills will also include the price tag. Industry leaders like Steve Ubel prefer their plan to list pricing options on dedicated websites.
We're concerned that if you just have the list price in isolation in the ad, it may deter patients from seeking needed care.
Of course, the proposed policy would only help people decide about elective medication. Those with chronic conditions still have to pay whatever the companies want to charge. Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Dr. Patel, I guess there's two things here. The actual abundance of these sort of medical ads on TV and then not knowing what these medicines cost. What do you think?
I think both are problematic. There's plenty of concern with direct-to-physician marketing of drugs, and that's been in the media in the past and appropriately so as a concern. Now, with the substantial number of advertisements directly to consumers, consumers are faced with this bombardment of advertisements. They don't necessarily get a good comparison between one drug versus another, so they only necessarily see maybe the name brand that's being advertised. Generics frequently are not advertised because there's not a manufacturer that stands to benefit. And so the generics, which may be just as efficacious in particular patient's condition or no different, what we would call non-inferior to a branded drug, they sort of get less airtime, face time, and consumers get less exposure to them. And from a physician perspective, I want to prescribe the right drug for the patient, whatever that might be. It might be a branded drug. It might be a generic drug. It may be a completely different drug, or it may not be any drug at all as appropriate to their medical condition. And when people see these advertisements with patients that are smiling and happy and feeling great and things like that, it can promote a false sense of security as to the how effective medications may be.
So what do you tell patients when they ask for a TV drug?
Well, I usually try to talk to them about what am I trying to treat and what are the effects and side effects of the various drugs that I might be using to treat a particular condition. And so then I'll recommend a choice based on the efficacy of the drug and perhaps their ability to acquire it. And that's where that price comes in. I think it is important to highlight the price from a consumer perspective, because many of these drugs, especially the name brand drugs, are going to be quite expensive, especially compared to, again, frequently just as effective generic drugs. And so without knowing the price, you might think, okay, well, I'll pay $2 extra for the name brand versus the quotes generic brand, but frequently the price is $200 more, or $500 more, or $1,000 more per day sometimes, and that is a substantial cost. And again, that cost then is passed along to society in the form of health insurance premiums that are going up, the cost of healthcare going up across the board, and the cost of marketing all of this that then gets passed along to the consumers as well. So there's a lot of little factors here that all add up. And in my mind, developing some sort of price transparency is helpful towards reducing that the financial burdens that we all face in the healthcare industry.
Dr. Patel, thanks for joining us again.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Come back at the end of the show with your health tip for the week.
Okay.
SLUCare's Dr. Nirav Patel is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. Up next, we'll take a look at two recent studies involving our heart. One concerns depression and stroke, the other on painkillers and the risk of heart attack. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. On the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A recent study found some painkillers up the risk of heart disease by 50%. Here to talk with us about that is SLUCare's Dr. Michael Lim. He's a cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim, thanks for joining us. What did this study find?
Well, this is a large study looking at 6.3 million people, studied them over a 20-year period of time. And these folks were sort of in their middle age, 46 to 56 years of age. And they were looking at NSAIDs, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, and specifically diclofenac, which is a non-steroidal drug. And they found that this medication was associated with a higher risk for heart conditions, including arrhythmias and heart attacks and other heart-related issues. So what's the deal here? The deal is that these types of medications, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, have been implicated for many years, not just diclofenac, but others. It goes back to the days of Vioxx, when that used to be there on the market, in terms of risk for heart disease and heart-related issues. So there's always been a concern. This is not a causal concern, meaning that the study was not designed to prove, per se, that this particular drug actually caused heart-related issues. But given the fact that how long it was studied and for how many people it was seen in, there is a level of concern that I think should be taken into account. And so the bottom line, with respect to anybody needing a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, especially over a period of time, not just transient use, so you sprain your ankle or that type of thing, but if you're going to take one of these medications for a longer-term basis, you ought to consult with your physicians. You ought to understand that there may be an increased cardiovascular risk and balance that with respect to the benefits you get out of this medication.
What is the name of the medication again?
Diclofenac.
Is that very popular? I mean, is that just over-the-counter, prescription only?
I think that one's a prescription-only drug, but it's sort of the natural question I think you can wonder is, so before, Fred, and there is some issues in terms of naproxen or naprosin, which is at that time was prescription-only, but I think you can get naproxen over-the-counter now. There's been issues in terms of Vioxx and other related issues like that. There's been a question about whether Motrin or ibuprofen, as another non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication, might have some cross-reactivity. And so these have all been in the undercurrent for a period of several years, almost a decade, of all being associated with increased cardiovascular risk. Not catastrophically high risk, but you know, the specific thing of question, Fred, is that these medications may increase your chance of forming blood clots, and those blood clots end up being part of that heart attack cascade. And so what's the right balance between taking these medications versus looking after your overall cardiovascular risk?
So if you're taking a painkiller over the counter for a long period of time, you should check with your doctor about it first.
Absolutely. I think that's the deal. So short-term usage, well, I got a headache today and I might take, you know, ibuprofen or an Advil. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is people taking these for a period of weeks or even chronically, meaning every day for a longer time period. Those are the ones that I think we really need to look into and have a real discussion of.
We're talking with Slew Care's Dr. Michael Lim. He's a cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim, I wanted to ask you about another study. This one found that anxiety and depression and other mental distress may increase the risk of heart attack and stroke in adults over 45. What's going on there?
So this is a decent type of analysis looking at over 220,000 people from Australia. And these were folks that were ages 45 and older who had not had previous stroke or heart attack. And they entered people into the study by characterizing every individual's sort of perception of stress and anxiety. And they sort of measured this on a questionnaire-type form. And then they followed them for almost 5 years. And the people with the highest levels of stress and anxiety had the highest rates of heart attack and strokes. This is a 250,000 people analysis that, again, is showing that there definitely is a mind-body connection. And when we are in high stress and anxiety or depression-type states, that we are very prone to having heart attacks or strokes, way more prone than people who don't feel these sensations.
So then what should we take home from this?
Well, I think we do need to pay attention to, you know, the concept of mental well-being in the sense of people's perception of self. It's very important. It's very hard to rid ourselves of stress in today's society. There's all kinds of things from financial stress to traffic to your cell phone to everything else that are demanding on you. So I think the focus should not necessarily be on, oh my gosh, my life is so stressed, but the opposite of trying to make sure that we have those releases for stress, make sure that we take time away, that we take time for ourselves, that we make sure that we have partnership and companionship to share our day's events and our life stories with each other as a way of making sure that this comes out and making sure that we don't try to deal with all these things alone. And although that's not a perfect recipe, it's a great start to trying to decrease that overall anxiety and stress level. And in that way, this study kind of shows that you'll fall into the lower risk group and have a smaller chance of having a heart attack or a stroke.
Dr. Lim, thanks for joining us. SLU Care's Dr. Michael Lim is a cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Next up, we'll find out about a possible new breast cancer vaccine. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Word of a possible new breast cancer vaccine. Here to talk about that with us is Dr. Andrea Baer. She's a breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in Lake St. Louis. Dr. Baer, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
I wanted to ask you about a story I've seen in the news at the end of the week. It's out of the Mayo Clinic saying that they see hope in a new breast cancer vaccine that they're working on. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so this is really exciting new news. It's not the first cancer vaccine that we've seen for breast cancer, but it is for a second type of breast cancer, which is really great that we're able to treat multiple types of breast cancer now with vaccines. Now, different than what you would traditionally think of as a vaccine and someone that would get a vaccine to prevent something, this is actually used in patients who have had breast cancer. So it's an additional part of their treatment along with chemotherapy. And the idea is that the vaccine can significantly reduce the chance of that breast cancer coming back, ideally, by really giving the immune system a boost to be able to fight those tumor cells with your own, your own immune system.
So this would fight the recurrence of this type of breast cancer?
Correct. So again, this wouldn't be given as a preventative measure, but it's given in someone who has, in this case, triple negative breast cancer, which is an aggressive form that tends to have a high recurrence rate. And so this is trying to bring down that recurrence rate in patients who have had triple negative breast cancer.
Is triple negative breast cancer, how different is that from HER2 positive breast cancer?
So there are basically two things that we look at in breast cancer, whether the tumor feeds off of estrogen and whether it expresses a protein called HER2. So the HER2 positive cancers are the ones that have been treated by vaccines or at least are in trial with vaccines for a while now. The triple negative cancers do not express HER2. So it's a different type and requires a different type of science to create a vaccine for that cancer. So vaccine for HER2 was the first trial, and now we're moving into the second era of vaccines for triple negative.
Dr. Baer, are you excited about the prospect of this new vaccine?
Yeah, I think that anything moving forward and talking about reducing women's risk of dying from breast cancer is fantastic. The only downside is it requires a lot of funding. And so I know the companies that are working on the trials with these vaccines do need funding support to be able to continue and see them through to the end.
We're talking with Dr. Andrea Baer. She's a breast surgeon with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in Lake St. Louis. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Let's take a few minutes now to talk about some of the basics about breast cancer. How common is it, Dr. Baer?
So the statistic of 1 in 8 is really kind of where we're still at. So, you know, about 12% of women will experience breast cancer in their lifetime. So quite common. I think everyone that has not been personally affected at least has a close friend or family member who has.
And how treatable is it?
So it's become much more treatable and also treatable with less aggressive treatment. Whereas 20, 30 years ago, everyone was getting chemotherapy. Now a large chunk of patients with breast cancer no longer require chemotherapy, which is a real win.
Is surgery the most common form of treatment still?
Surgery is almost always a part of your treatment, but really you have to look at systemic treatment as well, which means treating the rest of the body, which surgery doesn't do. So in those cases, we're talking about adding either chemotherapy or an anti-hormone pill.
What surgeries do you do there at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in Lake St. Louis for breast cancer?
Mm-hmm. So essentially in breast, you can boil it down to two basic options. You can either have a partial mastectomy or a lumpectomy where just the cancer and a little bit of normal tissue is removed around it, or you can have removal of the breast entirely, which is mastectomy. And the mastectomy can be done with or without reconstruction, where a plastic surgeon would recreate the breast, and that's done usually at the same time as the mastectomy. It's almost always an option for the patient to choose which surgery is going to work best for them. So it's an extensive discussion that you should have with your surgeon about what your expectations are and what kind of your goals are so that you can find the right operation for you.
Let's talk about prevention methods. What are some good methods for preventing the occurrence of breast cancer?
So there are basically three things that we know we have some control over that increase your risk of breast cancer, and those are obesity, smoking, and alcohol. So those are the three things that I counsel people on to try and keep control over, because those are the three things we can do for ourselves that we know decrease your risk of breast cancer.
So what's your advice on smoking and alcohol?
Well, of course, everyone's going to tell people not to smoke because breast cancer is only one of the many things, of course, that it contributes to, including lung cancer, other cancers, heart disease. And in terms of alcohol, it's not someone who's having a glass of wine on a Friday night. This is really people that are having multiple drinks a day, every day, that we see that spike in breast cancer rates.
You mentioned obesity. Can physical activity reduce the risk of breast cancer?
Absolutely. Physical activity and being at a healthy weight reduces your risk of breast cancer and also significantly reduces your risk of a recurrence if you've had breast cancer in the past. So I talk to my breast cancer survivors about how important exercise is because it can cut your recurrence rates down almost as much as some of these adjuvant therapies that patients have to have.
And how about a healthy diet? How critical is that in preventing breast cancer?
It takes a lot for us to prove with science that something is significant in increasing your risk of cancers, but in general, we tend to think that a more plant-based diet or a less processed diet is beneficial. Again, there's the jury's still out on whether that scientifically decreases your risk, but that tends to be kind of the thought process.
Is there a link between hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer?
So a big trial back in the 80s showed when they were looking at hormone replacement and risk of cardiac events that some of the women did have a spike in breast cancer if they were on the hormones. So if you have an estrogen-positive breast cancer, of course it's going to feed off of that hormone supplementation. So it can increase, or we have seen an increase in rates of breast cancer in patients on hormone therapy. Now, whether the hormone replacement really caused the breast cancer or whether it caused an existing cancer to show up earlier because of feeding those cells and causing more rapid growth is kind of the debate.
A couple more questions for you about prevention. Does a family history of breast cancer put someone at higher risk?
Yes. So there are a bunch of different factors that increase your risk of breast cancer, namely its exposure to estrogen, and then family history. So if you speak to your physician or to a breast specialist, you can calculate your personal risk of breast cancer based off of those risk factors. So family history does play a role, and it really depends on who the family member is and how old they were, things like that. So if you have a family history, it's absolutely worth talking to a specialist about what your risk is because there may be additional screening modalities that would be eligible, as well as the discussion about genetic testing.
Let's talk about mammograms. What are the guidelines for timing on getting mammograms?
So women at age 40 should be getting their baseline mammogram and then having one every year. There's no real agreed-upon time that you stop them. That being said, if you have a family history of breast cancer, you may need to start your mammograms earlier, depending on how old your affected relatives were.
And breast self-exams, how often should those be done and what should you be looking for?
I think a monthly exam is perfectly appropriate. So people tend to plan it around something that's also monthly so that they don't forget. I think that mammogram is really the most important aspect, though, because most often it will pick things up long before we can feel them on a self-exam.
Dr. Baer, what's your bottom line advice for women when it comes to breast cancer?
Yeah, bottom line is that you need to get your mammograms. There's no replacement for it. It's the only modality that's been shown to save lives from breast cancer. So no excuses. Walk-in screening mammograms don't require orders. You can get them at any of the SSM facilities. We all have 3D mammogram, which is another good advance in the science. So get your 3D mammogram.
And a diagnosis of breast cancer these days is not a death sentence.
Absolutely not. No, lots of patients are surviving and thriving, and if caught early by mammogram, it's very treatable.
Dr. Baer, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Andrea Baer is a breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in Lake St. Louis. Coming up next, we'll talk about a new digital PET CT scanner. It's now ready for use in the St. Louis area. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital is the first in the region to offer digital PET CT scans. For more information on that, we turn to Dr. Jeff Brown. He's the chair of radiology for SLU Care and SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Brown, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Dr. Brown, what is this new PET CT?
Well, this is an imaging technique that combines PET, which is positron emission tomography with CT, which is a CAT scan, and it gives us very high-resolution pictures. We use it mainly for patients with cancer. There's some other uses for it as well, but it's primarily used for cancer patients. And we've got a brand-new state-of-the-art machine that was just installed this week. It's the first one in the region, and it's an all-digital PET CT scanner.
What were they in the past?
Well, they were PET CT scanners, but they used analog technology in the detectors, which was not as efficient. So the all digital technology allows higher sensitivity in detecting the signal, and that has several advantages for our patients.
Now, PET CT scans have been around for a while. How has this changed treatment plans?
Well, there's three main advantages for our patients. One is just patient comfort. The older technology required kind of a long scan. It could take 40 minutes, 45 minutes, even an hour for a whole body scan. And with a newer technology, with our new machine, we can get the scan done in 40 minutes or less, sometimes 20 minutes. That's an advantage for patient comfort. There's also a patient safety advantage in that the radiation dose is significantly lower with this new technology. And so that's good for our patients as well. And then the final advantage is we expect the diagnostic accuracy to be better because of the higher sensitivity for detecting cancer lesions. So we think it'll really help our patients in all three ways.
How big of a deal is this for St. Louis University to get this type of technology?
Well, I mean, for me as a radiologist, I think it's a huge deal, and I'm actually very grateful to our partners at SSM Health because this is an expensive technology, and they're building a brand new hospital for us. If you've driven by Grand Boulevard recently, you'll see the hospitals being built as we speak, and so they could have just waited a year and a half and bought this scanner when the new hospital opens, but they understood that this technology will help our patients right now. And so they bought it, and we're going to move it into the new hospital in a year and a half when the hospital's done.
How big is something like this?
It occupies basically two rooms. So you have the scanner room and then a control room. And so if you've seen a CAT scanner or an MRI, it's a similar size, basically.
Dr. Brown, thanks a lot for telling us about the new digital PET CT scanner. It'll be available at SSM Health's new hospital beginning this week.
My pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Dr. Jeff Brown is the chair of radiology for SLU Care and SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Well, we're at that time of the show again where we bring back our co-host, SLU Care's Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist there. Dr. Patel, what's your health tip for the week?
Well, we talked a lot about the direct-to-consumer marketing of drugs, and then we also talked about breast cancer and ensuring that you come up with a personalized treatment plan for you with your physician. And I think that highlights an important factor here in that you want to make sure you have a good doctor-patient relationship, and your physician then can advise you on the best treatment for you. There may be good treatments out there for other folks, but you need the best treatment for you. And I think that comes in the form of a good discussion with you and your physician. So my health tip of the week is don't fall for marketing scams. Talk to your doctor.
Dr. Patel, thanks again. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for joining us. I really do appreciate it. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Join us again next week at this time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.